you think foster care was bad, my dad was even worse. You know, he would leave us for days sometimes without food, just leave the house. When he would come back, it was just beating after beating.
This is the Dor McCallum Podcast, and our guest this week is George Diaz. What happens when both of your parents get sent to prison? You and your two siblings get put into the foster care system. At least, that's what happened to George by the age of 4. Battling rejection, abuse, and even depression, George did not live an easy life. It seems like every time something good happened, it was short-lived and life would get worse for George. This week, you'll hear how a young man went through so much, but was still the life of the party. This is part one of a two-part episode. Abuse, mental health, military duty, salvation. Make sure to stay tuned for this true life story you do not want to miss. George, you've lived a pretty rough life. Can you tell us your earliest memory of your parents?
My mom and dad, the earliest memories that I have of them, wasn't with him for quite a long time. But what I remember is empty apartments, baby in a diaper, boogers everywhere, drugs, alcohol, and being taken away from them because they were in their drug addict lifestyle.
I think you mentioned to me your parents, they were actually Mexican nationals, but they were living in the States.
Yes. So they were, my grandparents immigrated to the States, and their children had the opportunity to become legal if they went ahead and graduated high school with no issues. My mom and dad decided to be in gangs, drugs, partying, and do those type of things where they both ended up in jail because of the lifestyle that they led.
And that was around age, I believe, 3 or 4, that both your parents were put in prison, leaving you and your siblings without parents. And at age 4, you were actually placed in foster care for about 2 years. Can you explain to us what you went through in that time?
Yes. So we were taken away from my parents. They were doing drugs in the front of their truck, and we were on the bed. I just remember a swarm of cops, you know, lights everywhere, and then us being stripped from them. We got put into foster care. The first place we went to is this place in San Diego called Polinski. That's where they, I don't know what they do there, but I guess they keep us there in the meantime that they find a home for us to be able to go to. In particular, there are 3 homes that I remember. 2 were really bad, and one of them was my mom's friend, which I still remember her name. Her name is Margie. But the 2 really bad ones, the reason they were really bad is there was a lot of physical and emotional, mental abuse that would happen. Handcuffed to places, being left alone. Holidays would come around and we would have to be separated from family. There was one instance with my first foster home. This lady was very physically abusive. She would make us stand in ant piles, red ant piles. And in those red ant piles, they would swarm us. And then when they got to our neck, that's when she would take us off. And then she would hose us down to make sure that she got every ant off of us. But by that time, I mean, you're getting bitten by thousands of these things. So, you know, it's pretty painful. There's so many things that happened there. That's the other second home that I remember. She was more of an emotional, not really physical, but more of an emotional abuse or psychological, really. I would cry a lot, obviously, right? Missing my parents. Like 4 years old, I miss my parents.
Right.
And so I would cry a lot at night. And what she would do is, she hated to hear me cry. So she would put me in the garage, in the middle of the garage on a stool. And she would tell me, you're not leaving here until you're done crying. Obviously, I wouldn't stop crying. So that's where I slept. The stool would get uncomfortable. So I would sleep on the cold garage floor. And I just cried and cried myself to sleep most of the time.
And this was for, like I said, about 2 years. You're six now, and it seems like you finally got a break. Your aunt, who lives in Mexico, she actually came onto the scene and pulled you and your siblings out of the foster system to live with her in Mexico. And at this time, you began to live a lavish lifestyle with her there. Was that lavish life short-lived, or did it go on for a long while?
Yeah, I still don't know to this day how that happened, right? She came and it felt like she rescued us. Finally, with some family, we had maids, each and every one of my brothers. We had one maid for each, so they would shower us, change us. We wouldn't lift a finger. If we wanted to go to the park, we had our three maids there to make sure we didn't fall, scrape our knee or anything.
Living the dream.
It was amazing. It was amazing. And then 2 months later, my dad shows up out of nowhere. I guess he got deported or something. And he's like, hey, I came to take you guys back.
Let me stop you right there. He comes onto the scene. Is he a brand new man? Did he learn something from spending time in prison, or?
I didn't know my dad. So I didn't know what he learned, what he didn't. But he didn't learn. As I go further, you're going to find out he didn't learn anything. You know, he took us from my aunt. We started living with him, and he was a big alcoholic, drug addict. So the abuse started really bad. If you think foster care, kept the PG, but you think foster care was bad, my dad was even worse. You know, he would leave us for days sometimes without food, just leave the house. When he would come back, it was just beating after beating. He would drown us sometimes and strangle us. Just a lot of stuff that would happen. He didn't want us to be happy. It felt like he didn't want us to be happy because he wasn't happy. If his girlfriends left him, then it was on me. I was the oldest. So, you know, sometimes we had a little courtyard where our water container was at. So whenever a girlfriend would leave him, he'd drown me, and then he'd leave me there for the rest of the night to sleep outside. You know, obviously I didn't die, but, you know, he tried. At least that's what it felt like.
Right. And this went on for about 4 years, you know, from the age of 6 to the age of 10. You were living this with your father, this reality of abuse. You know, to you, how were you processing that? What, you know, you were a child, but what did you feel during that time?
I tried to be as optimistic as I could, right? I had to grow up very fast. So I was the one that when we had food, I'd cook. You know, I'd try to take care of my brothers. The problem with that was that I was taught by my dad. So you could just imagine. I wasn't the best brother, which later on really hurts me, but I wasn't the best brother. We would steal sometimes for food. Most of the time, I felt mad. I felt pain, and I was more mad at myself and my brothers for some reason. I think because I had to grow up so fast. Wasn't really mad at my dad. It was weird. It was more like I just wanted his attention, his love, even though he did these things to me. You know, kind of like a puppy, right? No matter how much you beat that puppy, he's going to love you because you're his owner. That's what I feel like. That's what I was. You know, no matter what he did. And he did a lot of things. You know, that's my dad did a lot of things to us.
Did you ever in this time, I mean, I know you're young, but you said you had to grow up so fast. Did you ever think of reaching out to your aunt or maybe even running away to your aunt or?
You know, that's the crazy thing is even during foster care, now with my dad, it never, that thought process never came through. Asking for help. Yeah, the closest thing asking for help was me running away sometimes. You know, you got a little 6-7-year-old running away in the streets of Mexico in the middle of the night, which was the worst decision to make, by the way, when you have an abusive dad. You know, I would run away, but then when he'd find me, somehow he'd find me. Biggest city in the world, the guy would find me, and it was not good, but I did it over and over, hoping that one day I could get away.
Well, And that went on, like we mentioned, for 4 years. You're 10 now. And it actually looks like you've gotten another break because somehow, by some miracle, your aunt orchestrates something where you are able to go back to the U.S. and live with your grandmother. So you leave your father, you leave that life. I believe you go back to the U.S. with your siblings. Did life change for you immediately once you stepped back? Was it a fresh start, or did you still experience hardship now in the States?
Yeah, so what I know of what happened is there was a lady that lived in front of us that once in a while would feed us. You know, she's the one that would sometimes take care of us. My dad would leave a lot of marks on us. Like, there's times in that courtyard where I had just blood all over me because of what he did to us. So one day she looked at it and my whole back was just covered with stripes because he got a wire hanger and decided to go, you know, do whatever he did. So she saw that and she was like, I guess that's the time where she said, that's enough. And she called my grandma, and my aunt came with the government, actually. I remember two guys in suits, and she's like, no, we're taking them.
The men in black.
Yeah, right. And they took me. We came back to the States, and I was like, finally, I was free physically, but mentally I wasn't. Mentally, I was still there. And starting school, because I came from Mexico, I forgot most of my English, so then I was bullied, you know, because they're like, oh, you're from Mexico. And it's like, dude, you're Mexican too. Like, what the heck?
Right. It seems like you went from one abuse to a whole different type of abuse now.
Exactly. You know, I was bullied in Mexico, but the States was worse. You know, over there I was bullied because I was from America. Over here I'm bullied because I'm from Mexico, right? So these bullies would every day in lunch would just beat me up. And it was like four of them against one. And one day I was like, you know what? It doesn't hurt as much as my dad. So I think I could stand up to these guys. So I did. One by one, I started beating them up till I got to the biggest guy. Now I knew I wasn't going to beat him. There's no way. This guy had a mustache and a beard in the fifth grade. There's no way I was beating this guy. But I stood up to him. And when I did, then they saw that. They're like, you know what? I guess they decided to become my friends. And I just started hanging out with them, unbeknownst to me of what was going to come.
You stood up to these bullies. You know, it kind of seems that way when you finally make a stand, these guys begin to respect you and you begin to hang out with them. You know, them kind of being those bullies to you, they were kind of, you can say, part of the wrong crowd. And now you've befriended them. And like you said, unbeknownst to you, now you're part of the wrong crowd. And they begin to introduce you to marijuana. Can you explain to us the first time you were introduced to that?
Yeah, so I had just become friends with them. And actually, funny thing is that I was very into Dare to Be Drug Free. I actually wrote essays and spoke and these preventative drug usage things, right? And one day I did a speech, and they were obviously laughing at me, but they're my friends now, so it's cool. At least I thought it was. And they're like, hey, man, what are you doing? Like, you want to get beat up again by other people? And I was like, no. He's like, well, come on, we'll show you what you need to be doing. So, you know, I sat there, and I'm looking at my essay. And the reason I was really into Dare to Be Drug Free is because of my dad and my mom. You know, that's all they were into. And I, like, their lifestyle was really bad. So
you,
like,
saw the long-term effects,
exactly,
of drug usage.
And what could what happened to me because of all those things.
Right.
But then I go with them and I'm like, well, they're my friends, so I'm going to go. I went with them and they take out this bag. I was like, oh, snap, oregano, right? What are we going to eat?
Where's the pizza?
Right? Where's the pozole? So they take out this bag, they start rolling the joint, and they're like, hey, you need to hit this. And I'm just like, well, what is it? And they're like, oh, it's weed. And I was like, okay. So then I just started smoking weed. And I felt different. It's like I felt the drug, that first, you know, I didn't believe that it was a gateway drug, but it truly, really is. Because there, that's when I started feeling a different sensation. Mm. You know, I got loose. My worries would kind of go away. So I'd smoke more.
Wow.
You know, because of my past, even though I was still young, I dealt with a lot of depression and anxiety. And that drug would kind of make it disappear.
Right, it would help you cope.
As long as I was high. Yeah, exactly. So as long as I was high, I was good.
And this was, I believe it was in fifth grade. And so you begin to do this. You're hanging out with this crowd. You go into sixth grade. Now you're 12, and your life actually took another dark turn, and you actually began doing cocaine.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. I had a lot of nightmares of what happened to me. You know, there's one in particular that I don't speak of, but that one would come up a lot, and I would want to erase it, just forget about it, and I couldn't. So that would get me, you know, really depressed. Weed was just not cutting out anymore. And hanging out with those people, with my friends at the time, you know, it just escalates eventually. So here comes cocaine into the scene. You know, sixth grade. I didn't know what it was. So they told me, you know, my dad broke my nose, so I couldn't really snort from one nostril. So I had to use the other one, and then there I went. And it was a different high.
Mm. Yeah.
So I liked it.
Another way to cope.
Another way to cope. And then they're like, oh, you should drink too. Now I had drinking before because my dad would make me drink because he thought he was cool. So I was like, oh, I can handle alcohol. So then I started drinking and I started doing cocaine. And from there, it just went downhill.
Right. I believe it wasn't necessarily specifically a gang, but you joined a sort of clique, you know, a group of rowdy kids who were trying to prove a point to a larger gang. Throughout your middle school years, you enter high school, you're living that lifestyle, trying to cope, trying to get away, you know, doing these drugs, drinking. It looks like in high school, you began to toy around or, you know, do meth. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So I was just trying to find the best high, but I'm scared of needles. So heroin was out of the question, right? Anything that I had to stick a needle in me, I was like, I can't do that for some reason. Right.
Right. You still have to have at least some kind of morals.
Yeah. You can call it that. But so I started doing pills, partying, you know, I really got just sucked into the lifestyle. I tried, you know, playing soccer was another passion of mine. But it, no matter what I did, I was with my friends all the time. So, you know, meth got introduced. One of the things, my cousin didn't want me to do meth because he did it and he was really bad into it. So he's like, oh, I don't want you to do it either. But one day I was really, really bad. I was just not having a good day. And I finally talked to him and we had a good talk. And he's like, well, I got something that can make you happy and longer than cocaine. And I was like, well, what is it? He's like, well, meth. And I was like, well, I thought you didn't want me to try it because you thought I was going to kill myself. And he's like, well, I think you need it, but I'll be here to help you.
Wow.
Right. So I took my first puff. And from then it's like I fell in love and it just took over. Yeah. I was a drug dealer at the time. So I would get it for free sometimes, and sometimes I'd pay very little for it and just sell it, but I would smoke it myself as well. And that's when the really reckless, my high school years is the really reckless me started to come out. You know, I was very scared of committing suicide. I wanted to, but I was never brave enough. And I found a way to, you know, the best and less painful way to do it is, well, drugs might help me. Alcohol might help me to do what I'm not brave enough to do. So I would drink till I was blacked out. I would, with meth, I would smoke with my cousin. And sometimes he'd be like, hey, dude, you're going to overdose. You can't smoke that much. And I was like, well, hand it over. And I'd do more, you know. And with the crazy thing is, no matter how much I did or how much I drank or how much I would put my life at risk, you know, I would do the dumbest things in my vehicle, in other people's vehicles. I mean, just reckless thing. I was going to, other gang members' turf by myself and try to jump people by myself. And then I would get beat up and then I'd come back. But no matter what I tried, no matter what I did, it's like I wasn't dying. So then I would do more and do more. And I couldn't stop.
Well,
I couldn't stop.
And so this was, like you said, all throughout high school when the reckless George was birthed. You're 16, you're a junior. You know, you're doing all these things, you know, like you mentioned. All this lifestyle, all these decisions that you made, all these actions you did you do all of these things to make you forget about your abusive past or this whole time where you just trying to prove a point to somebody?
Most of it was, well, my past, you know. Like, if I were to, we would sit here for like 3 hours, you know, if we were to go through every single piece of what I went through. And it's a lot. Especially, you know, early on, where all you know is pain. So you know nothing else but pain.
Right.
And then, you know, that's 10 years of abuse. Now you're trying to forget that, right? That's where I was at. I'm trying to forget. I'm trying to move on. The thing is, I was trying to move on my way. And one of the things that I remember, I would always tell myself is I wasn't going to be like my mom. I wasn't going to be like my dad. You know, my mom and dad, always in and out of jail, especially my mom. I really didn't know her. Always in and out of jail. And but then at the end of the day, because of the depression and everything, I became them, you know. And I was 16 years old at the time, and I realized where I was headed. You know, we have there's a song that we used to play all the time, 18 with a bullet, right? You know, either you're gonna be in jail or you're gonna die at 18. And that was like my song, right? That was my future.
That
was my life.
Yeah.
Either I'm gonna die at 18 or I'm gonna go to jail because of that bullet. And that was our motto. You know, we're like thinking 16, 15 year old, and that's what we thought, that's our life is going to be.
You embrace that, yeah.
But yeah, that's what it was going to be. And I got into some trouble, and I decided, you know, to go with my aunt, who was in West Virginia. And that's where I got a little dose of God, because she was a Jehovah's Witness. And I was with her for about a year. Obviously, I was clean because I didn't know anybody.
Right. You didn't have access to drugs.
Well, let's just say, you know, like, I mean, I was the only Mexican in a school of 5,000, me and my sister. So I didn't have a lot of friends.
That's enough said right there.
I didn't have a lot of friends, so I couldn't get a lot of stuff. And I was there for a year. And that's where I got my first real scare of almost dying, because I was mowing the lawn for one of the churches, the Jehovah's Witness church. And I passed out. I remember passing out. I end up in the hospital, and they tell me that I had, you know, like two bleeding peptic ulcers, and they were eating at my stomach lining. If I would have never passed out in 3 months, I would have just, my stomach acid would have like come out and just destroyed my insides, you know. And believe it or not, my first thought was like, oh, dang, that was my ticket out, and I messed up.
Wow.
You know, and, 16, you know, I didn't see a future. I didn't see me being useful, anything, because I wasn't, because I was just like my mom and my dad.
And so you were for 1 year there in West Virginia. You eventually returned to California. Even though you've been sober for a year, you've been clean, you had some experience with religion. When you come back to Cali, you actually just go back to the same lifestyle. The same old friends, the same old drugs, being reckless. And you eventually, you know, saw something as a way out of your destructive life. Can you explain that? What was that way out that you saw?
Yeah, so I got tired of God, of what I thought was God.
Right.
And I told my aunt, I want to move back to California. This is not working out. I still had nightmares. You know, I'm just trying to find something to cope with. Still was depressed and everything. Just, you know, that's crazy. But I didn't talk about it. Never did. Actually, this is one of the first times that I do with anybody. It was more of I suppressed it every single time.
Right.
Because I was a man. So I suppressed everything and instead put on a show. So you're hearing this side of me, while everybody else knows a different story. because I put on a mask. So in front of everybody, if you were to talk to my family, they would say I was perfect.
Hmm.
Good grades in school. I was respectful. I did everything right. But because I was so good at hiding all the suffering, all the pain, everything that I tried to go through. And I wanted to go back to that. So I did. I came back to California and I went back into the same lifestyle. I met my girlfriend, and now my wife, but at the time my girlfriend. And I decided that I needed, you know, if I really, at the time, I really loved her. I thought, well, what I felt was love. And I was like, oh man, I really like this girl. I need to be better. You know, I need to be able to live, you know, I need to get my act.
We'll have to stop the story right there for now, but don't worry. Next week, the second half of George's testimony will be even more powerful than this one. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss out when the next episode drops. And also, please share this story with someone that you know who might be going through a similar situation. You just never know how much a testimony can impact someone's life. I'm Beto Rivas, and we will talk to George some more next week.